Welcome back to On the Mic with Mike Peters. My guest this week is Austin comedian JT Haberstadt. He runs the Altercation Comedy Festival in Texas, which begins on October 27th. It's a great festival with some of the best comedians across the country. If you're an avid listener of this podcast, you're going to recognize some names. Zach Hammond's going to be there, Shafi Hossein, Richard Douglas Jones, JP Leonard, Sam Ike, and then Brian Posehn and Eddie Pepitone are headlining. It's stacked. JT came up through the punk scene, and we talked a lot about that and producing shows and what he looks for in a good comedian. He's an awesome guy, really funny. Go see him live if you can. He'll be starting an East Coast tour with Eddie Pepitone on September 30th in Albany. He's doing 2 dates in Poughkeepsie. They're going to be all over the East Coast, including the Rogue Island Comedy Festival on October 7th, all down the coast. Go see him. Also, I want to mention JT told a story about coming to a music venue in Binghamton, and I screwed up. I remember the name of the venue. It's Magic City Music Hall in Johnson City, and I knew it. I wrote it down, but I forgot to bring it up again to prove to everybody that I know my stuff. Maybe I was too distracted by the fact that I had seen Sum 41 and Unwritten Law there. So I apologize. I'm not as big an idiot as you thought. Still an idiot. Not as big an idiot as you thought. Anyway, please like, share, review, and subscribe to the podcast. If you like what you hear, sign up for the Patreon. It's only $5 a month. Thanks so much again. I'll talk to you guys next week. Take care. Peeling back my sunburned skin. I'll wait outside your bedroom. I hope they let me in. You want to go?
Yeah, let's do it. Thanks for having me.
No problem, man. Thanks for doing this. This is fun. It's not often I get a recommendation from a guy in Louisiana that I actually want to follow up on. So this is, no, JP Leonard, I had him on and he's like, no, he should got to talk to this guy, JT. Yeah, man. Well, how's everything going in Austin?
You know, chaotic. It's okay. I get asked that a lot because Austin right now is kind of on the bubble of everyone's mind, I guess, with Rogan living here now and just all the things, you know, a lot of LA moving here and our fucking insane governor and just all the, everything that's going on.
But I thought Greg Abbott was fun.
I hate that guy.
Does anybody, honestly, like does anybody like who isn't like 50 plus like that guy?
I don't know. I see once in a while. I mean, the part of the reason I'm from New York originally, so I've been in Austin 15 years. And part of the reason that I, you know, moved here is because Texas doesn't necessarily align with a lot of the South for me, you know, where I've been to like Mississippi or Alabama or places where I just kind of go, woof, ideology wise. And so lately though, it's been almost like I don't recognize this place with a lot of this shit. It's been hard to swallow. But answer your question, man, I don't know. I mean, I see a lot of born and bred Texas people that kind of follow in their parents' political footsteps, which is strange to me. You know, I see a lot of like college students being like, keep Texas red and like just kind of echoing things that their parents post to our 50 plus or whatever. And that's weird to me because as a teenager or young person, I was very much the opposite of that. But I don't know. I don't want to go too far down the rabbit hole of politics and
well,
shit.
We're in minute two. It seems appropriate.
I'm just spiraling immediately. But I'm kind of a ragey, ranty guy. And so it's very frustrating to me, all this bullshit that's going on right now. And it informs, you know, Austin as a whole, what people think about it in terms of just, you know, wanting to come here and what comedy is and all the other things too. There's a lot of old guard comedians here that are feathers ruffled about, you know, the LA invasion. And on one hand, I get it because as an Austin-based comic, a lot of us were trying to keep things sane and reopen slowly, you know. And then you have a lot of people moving here in January going, there's so many open stages that it's like, yeah, you fucking moron. That's intentional. We're trying to be safe and get it back. And you just have these first year in chuds that are just like, man, I can get up every night of the week and do my edgelord hot takes. It's like this weird gold rush where, you know, it's not that there's so much stage time. It's that, and there is a good scene here. You can get up a lot, but it's that the people that run stuff and are trying to do it smart, the actual comics based here, are holding back. So that made for a lot of real scene waves, I guess you could say, you know, and we got a lot of local media that were like, it's the new mecca of comedy. We interviewed Johnny Dipshit, who formerly lived in Missouri and has been here 7 days, and he can't believe it. You know,
yeah, just, Johnny Dipshit, he knows his shit.
He does. You know, his middle name's Dip, Mr. Dip. But also, man, I'm on such the edges of it all. Like, I know almost everybody in the Austin scene, or in some regard, there's new people moving here all the time, every day. But most of the main players I know in some regard, but also I'm a road dog. And so when I'm home, I'm not doing comedy. You know, when I'm at, like right now, I'm on a 5-week break between tours and I don't go out again until September 23rd. And, you know, comedy is the last thing on my mind right now. I don't. So
well, thanks,
I
mean, for doing this podcast. No, I didn't mean to completely fuck up your vacation, but
no. It's not a vacation by any means. It's just a departure. You know, it makes me then I'm refreshed and ready to go on the road again. And I do stuff like this. I do interviews and things, but I'm not out hitting mics. You know what I mean? Like I might do a spot between now and when I leave just to kind of dust the cobwebs off. But I think I do maybe 6 Austin shows a year, you know, and most of those are headlining for money. or, you know, I mean, I'm on tour with Eddie Pepitone right now a lot. And so, or it's, you know, the two of us or something. We did The Creek in the Cave here back in April. It was our first shows back.
Eddie is fucking manic.
He's wonderful. We align so well because it's funny, when we first met, he thought I was a Texan and I thought he was a Hollywood big shot.
Right.
And then we both realized, no, we're both New Yorkers. And so we speak the same ball-busting language and just really hit it off quickly.
One of his old buddies is Paul Kozlowski, and I work with him a lot.
Uh-huh. And I know the name.
Yeah, Paul has, I mean, it's really creative and it's funny, but it's like he calls it himself Larry Woodchucksky. So he's like, he dresses up like a woodchuck. And then he showed this clip. It was like a half hour special. And at one point, you see this older guy wearing a ladybug costume. And you're like, son of a bitch, is that Eddie Pepitone?
Sure is.
And it was. And I'm like, that guy will do anything.
Eddie has literally been in every show. I mean, it's so funny now because we talk all the time, even when we're not on the road. And I'll be texting with him and then he'll just come on like It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia or something while I'm watching it. I'm like, dude, what the fuck? You're on my TV right now. Like he's just literally been in every show and it's great. I mean, he's just such a perfect character actor and so damn good at it. But for me, I mean, you know, his stand-up is where it's at. I think he's one of the best, definitely one of the best currently still active. And probably one of the best ever. I mean, he's just so naturally good at it. And every show, every night is different. You know,
but it just seems like he just popped all of a sudden and that now he's everywhere. And I know that's not the case.
What's funny about that is, I don't want to insert myself too much into the narrative, but he had that movie come out, which was The Bitter Buddha, which got him a lot of kind of new eyes. And, you know, he's just a prolific writer and his last special for the masses, you know, got best comedy special of 2020 by the New York Times. And that got him a lot of like new eyeballs from a different crowd too. I think there's a percentage of comedy fan that may not watch, you know, Your Pretty Face Is Going to Hell on Adult Swim at 1 a.m. You know what I mean? That was very aware of him. But the other thing is, man, you know, he called me up in 2019 and basically said, hey, I want to go on the road like you do. Do you want to team up? And I said, fucking absolutely. And he said, all right, how about you want to start in like 2 weeks? And I was like, you're out of your mind. I was like, I can't book anything in 2 weeks. I can book you some shows maybe, but dude, I can't book us a run in 2 weeks. And I managed to book us something in 7 weeks. You know, by 2 months later, we were on the road and hitting it. But what I didn't know, because I consider him such a stand-up legend, is that he hasn't really toured. You know, he had done major markets like L.A. and New York and Chicago. And I think he did a festival down in like Orlando, like the Indie Comedy Fest down there. But really just kind of fly out one-off special events or club weekends in like, you know, in Brooklyn or some shit like that. Right. You know? I mean, when we started going places, I was like, dude, you've never been to New Orleans? He's like, nope. I'm like, you know, there's so many places. I don't even know if he had done Philly before, you know, and so
You can get lost in New York City and wind up in Philly.
You can. But I mean, it was awesome for me because I've been just about everywhere. And so taking him to these new places was great, you know, but not just like, oh, I can take you to New Orleans and that's, you know, a city that's super unique and the show will be awesome and all those things. But seeing people so excited to see him who had never, you know, you've never come to fucking Wichita. You know, yeah. We go to these kind of smaller markets and we went to Wichita, Kansas, and it was a Sunday night in the snowstorm and the place was packed out the fucking door, man. And people were so on fire to see him. And it was just so like being able to, since our team up, I guess, kind of take him to new places and kind of introduce him to new scenes has been really cool. And it's been really neat to see for both of us kind of the snowball effect in terms of recognition and just response. And so I think the culmination of the movie had a lot to do with people being aware of Eddie, but then the combination of just him writing so well and his last special being so great and just him getting out there and hitting the road and, you know, being that undeniable force live on stage, it just adds up to people get excited about it, you know? And yeah, man, it's fucking rad. Like the shows have been doing very well. We've been trying to be really smart and pace them out and not throw safety out the window or anything. We're both obviously super vaxxed up as much as you can be and all that shit. But it's really heartening to see the response from everybody to these shows.
How'd you two hook up?
We were both at the time signed to Stand Up Records out of Minneapolis. So I was aware of him. I had actually never seen The Bitter Buddha before we met, the documentary. I didn't see that until after we started working together, which was kind of funny. I just knew him as a stand-up that I really liked. And I run this thing, the Altercation Comedy Festival out of Austin.
Never heard of it.
It's a fledgling. It's a fledgling startup. There's a Kickstarter.
That should be just to fuck with people.
Yeah. And I think it was the third year in, I was like, I really want to get Pepitone this year. And there was a comic that I really like, who's also on Stand Up Records, named Whitney Chitwood. She's based out of Chicago. And Whitney and I were buddies. And I knew that she had worked with Eddie a few times and just raved about what a nice guy he was, but I hadn't really met Eddie. And so she gave me his email and I kind of lucked out because he had just fired his current booking agent at the time. And so I was able to just get a hold of him directly. He was kind of booking his own shit, which is how I like to work anyway with the festival when I can. And so I invited him out. I, you know, shot him an offer and he said yes right away. And he had heard about the fest and he flew out here and we went out. I knew he was vegan. And so I picked him up and Ben Roy, who's with the Grolix, who's in Those Who Can't on True TV and stuff. And they had worked together on that show. And I picked them both up and took them to this vegan restaurant that's in town here called Mother's in Austin for lunch. And we just really hit it off. Like I said, I think it was that intangible New York thing that, you know, we just were busting balls immediately. And Ben Roy and I had been on tour together for like 3 weeks earlier in the year. And so we were like, you know, cousins busting each other's balls. Like yeah. We just talk shit to each other nonstop. And so it was just a fun afternoon of hang time. And then the shows, you know, the shows went really well. The festival went really well. The response to his set was fucking great. And that was pretty much our first introduction. It was just a really positive experience. And then the next year for the festival, I had another old friend of mine who I constantly want to strangle sometimes, which is Doug Stanhope. He's like my comedy Yoda. You know, when I first started out, Doug was one of the first people to kind of give me spots opening for him and stuff. And Doug was supposed to come out and do the festival. And at the last minute, he had to cancel because he got a book deal. But I was it's okay. I get it. And he was very apologetic. And, you know, I still love him forever. But at the time, I was very pissed off because I said, Doug, I fucking have to announce in 3 days.
Yeah, you booked everybody around you.
Dude, everything's booked around it. I have to announce and put tickets on sale in 3 days. I have sponsors attached. I can't, you know, try. Who do I, off the top of my head, let's just replace Doug Stanhope in 72 hours. Fuck me. And so I was really like, I don't know what I'm going to do. And then I was like, well, I hate to repeat people year to year, but let me call Eddie. You know, like we hit it off and we had kind of stayed in touch a little bit. And so I called up Eddie and I said, hey, man, would you do me a solid and come in? He's like, absolutely. He had the date free. I was like, oh, thank God. So he kind of saved my ass there. And again, he came in and we just hit it off. And I guess from that experience on his end too, he saw how I kind of run things when I'm in producer mode, because, you know, it's spinning plates and juggling kittens when there's 80 plus comics and it's four nights plus a brunch and all this other shit going in. So, but I used to run shows before I even got into comedy. I put on punk shows and stuff back in New York back in the day. And so I like that producer aspect of stuff. I can switch those roles from comic to producer pretty well. And I guess it made an impression on Eddie because, that year everything was sold out across the board, every show. And so he had a great time and I just took care of him as best I could and made sure he didn't, have to do anything except concentrate on his set, basically, which is how I try to run things for everybody. And that planted the seed between that and him seeing my tour dates when I wasn't doing the festival. That's what led him. He told me to want to call me up and say, hey, let's work together doing shows together. Cause he liked how I produced stuff and was kind of no bullshit. And he also, like I said, had at the time separated ways with his prior booking agent. So essentially right now I handle all the booking for Eddie and I completely. So there's, it's very streamlined. We're booked through we're booking for March of next year right now.
That's crazy.
So it's good problems, like I said, but that's how we met. And the initial tour I very much did with Kid Gloves. I kept it to like 8 or 9 dates because I was like, I don't want him to feel obligated if he turns out, because touring on the road is different than hanging out as friends, and I certainly didn't want it to be something where he's like, oh, now I'm married to this dude. You know what I mean? But we just really hit it off and we just really enjoyed touring together. So it's been great, man. And knock on table so far. Yeah. When you're together with somebody for 2 straight weeks and then, you get home and 2 days later, you're still texting each other and talking shit, talking about how you can't wait for the next shows. That's usually a good sign. So
yeah,
really lucky,
Yeah. There are people I work with and I absolutely love them on stage. And I love them all, but it's like when I get home, we're done.
Oh,
like,
absolutely.
It's not even touring with them. It's just like, oh, I've had 3 shows this week with them. It's like, time for a little bit of a break.
That's absolutely healthy. And, my biggest mistake when I first started touring was I wanted my own kind of comedy Ramones. I had this thing, Alteration Punk Comedy Tour, and I wanted me plus 3 or 4 other comics that I really liked, kind of a comedians of comedy thing, but more underground, because none of us had TV credits.
I know, it's easy to be underground when nobody knows who the fuck you are.
Yeah, exactly. Because this is 2008, 2009. And, doing rock clubs, one-nighters and everything like that. And we were just starving and we were close friends at the time. But now, I go through and I'm certainly not in touch constantly with any of those motherfuckers.
Yeah.
And I think I'm on good terms with 1 or maybe 2. You know what I mean? It's just the nature of the beast. Touring is hard. Even when it's good, even the level, Eddie and I are what I call working class comics, so the deals are reasonable and there's a hotel involved and all that. We're not sleeping on couches and grinding to a point where it's physically taxing us, but it's still work. And it's still, even under those conditions, man, there's moments of stress and, you're on airplanes and fucking renting cars and just all the aspects of the day to day that go into getting to the show. So yeah, I feel really lucky that we can kind of weather all that and still really enjoy each other's company and comedy,
There used to be a theme with my podcast and it was completely incidental. Like I would talk to somebody and maybe they would see a background, like I've got a bunch of punk albums on the back. And like, it seemed like punk rock is like a through line for comedy. It's like do you see that at all? Like what similarities from the punk field to comedy field are there? I mean, it just seems like it's just for me, it's like the attitude and the DIY aspect or not taking yourself too seriously.
Absolutely. All those things. I mean, if you Google my name and punk, you're going to get a lot of fucking articles because for better or worse, I'm kind of branded as the punk comedy guy.
Yeah.
And I branded it as such back in the day. I thought it was something that made sense to me for all those reasons you just said, which was not that I had a mohawk or I was going to get up there and tell dancing jokes. But that six people would get. Well, that was the main thing. A lot of people heard punk comedy and went, well, what's that? Which is a great talking point if you're doing press. But if you have people that are curious to come see you, they may go, I'm not going to get it. Or this guy's going to fucking Gigi Allen his way and like hit me in the face with a microphone or something. They don't understand. To me, it was a no-brainer because I was a Black Flag kid. I was a Discord Records kid. I was going down to CBGB's almost every other weekend on the train when I was fucking 15. And so to me, it just made sense, which was just like, I'm not going to wait a year to work my way up in the local club to a hosting 10-minute spot. Fuck that. I'm going to go. I'm going to book my own shit. The club doesn't want to book me because I'm not vetted. Well, I'm going to book the rock club down the street and go fuck yourself, you know? So that was all it was to me. It was not wanting to have any sort of handcuffs in terms of what I could say, which now, unfortunately, a lot of people take that open stages thing and the allowance, because there is a lot more allowance now in terms of places you can get up and have kind of free reign over topics. And they kind of abuse it because they just have shitty hot takes and there's no comedy there. You know, you get the edgelord thing, which,
there's no punchline.
There's no pun. There's no comedy. You know, the first part is to be funny. And if you have a message too, fucking rad. But there's a reason why there's only one Bill Hicks or one Stanhope or one George Carlin. It's because to have a message included that's poignant and hard hitting has to be tethered to funny. Yeah. You know what I mean? And so many times people who have these, the audience can't handle me. It's not, no, there's no fucking material there.
You suck.
Or I'm a big proponent also of, you can say, no word to me is off limits. Uh-huh. You can say any word you want. However, you better have a good point to using that word if it has power. You know what I mean? And so that's something that obviously Carlin did very well. Carlin was fearless with that. But you can see it with Chappelle now, or even Rogan. You know, there's people that Rogan gets the edgelord thing applied to him a lot. And I understand why. he makes a lot of questionable fucking decisions, I think. But also his last two specials were really fucking funny. And he did some stuff I thought with language by turning it on its head that I thought was really smart and well done. You know, he wasn't just saying, Bill Burr also, you know, Bill Burr is fearless with words. This is nothing that you don't know.
The thing I like about Burr is that like Patrice O'Neill too. It's like they will start out with something that you're like, I can't get on board with this. And they'll talk for 5 minutes. They're like, oh, you know what? He's got a point.
I mean, I went to Stanhope's last taping. I don't know if you've seen his latest special.
No, I don't think so.
I forget the name of it, but I was at his last taping and I hadn't seen the hour that he was doing yet. And Doug has this bit about, I mean, he's Stanhope, so he could, you know, the reason he can get away with so much is A, his audience is diehard. They'll jump in front of a fucking train for him. But also, he always has a point to his stuff. He's never saying. So he did this bit about how Indian, like Pakistani Indian people, dudes, can only rape in packs. And I was like, oh my God, Doug. I'm listening to him do this live and there's cameras rolling and I'm like, oh my, I've known this dude for a decade. I'm going, you're fucking, I'm sitting here with my jaw on the floor going, how is he going to get out of this? He's talking about how he said Indian men are the women of the rape world or something fucking crazy, because there's all this, I guess, data about, you know, group rapes in fucking India. I don't know. I don't want to go too much because it is not my bit, but he somehow tied it all in and made it this fucking amazing bit that was, I mean, it was brave. I mean, talk about walking a tightrope, you know, because it could have very easily gone horribly, horribly wrong. And it's a topic that I wouldn't have touched with a 20-foot pole, but Jesus Christ, if he didn't pull it off, you know, and he had people laughing and nobody was upset, but it's because people know where his heart is at. And they know that he's not saying that just to paint like Indian people as rapists or something fucking Trumpish. You know what I mean? Like this kind of xenophobic bullshit. So yeah, it's very much a punk rock thing. You know, to me, punk rock is doing your own thing and not waiting around for somebody to give you a green light. And also, I mean, again, I'm 45 now. I've been doing this for like 12, 13 years. And so it's, I don't know if I'd have the same attitude now as far as comfort and making money, because this is my job, but a degree of fuck it. I'm going to go do this for art and fuck money. And, you know, like I'm not going to let money dictate my pathway.
Yeah.
You know? We starved for the first 2 years doing it and it was real hard, you know, but that's where the punk rock thing informs it. And it certainly to this day informs how I book stuff. Cause like I said, with the festival and with booking Eddie and I'm very much, it's why I try, if it's the only pathway, I will deal with agents, but so many times they just get in the way and fuck things up and make things so much harder than they need to be. And that's just through experience of using them. It's not an ideological thing of me being like, fuck the man, I'm not dealing with your agent sellout.
Yeah.
You know, it's just experience of trying to book people the right way and having it turn into a fucking ridiculous red tape nightmare when it doesn't need to be, when I can just pick up the phone and book somebody, you know?
I book a ton of rooms in New York. Uh-huh. And I like before the pandemic, I had 14 rooms. Now I've got 12. So I'm rebuilding.
Wow. Cool.
And a lot of those are like monthly shows or twice a month shows. I like the fact that I can leave my equipment in my car and yeah. I can set up. Like I got a show tonight. So at 5:30, I'm going to leave. And by 7, I'll be all set up.
What kind of venues are you mainly doing? Like rock clubs or like?
No, mostly bars.
Okay. Yeah.
Mostly bars. I got one room's a basement and it's like a punk rock basement.
Yeah.
So it's kind of cool. And it's kind of like a throwback, like for the most part, I'm getting budgets from the bar for all these shows. So there's actual money in there. So I know like, which takes a lot of the stress off for me. It's like, okay,
sure,
cool. The money's there. It's not coming out of my pocket. The punk basement is kind of like a throwback to where we started from. It's like $5 at the door.
Right.
And we might get 20, 25, 30 people there, but it's always a ton of fun. We only had 2 shows there so far.
Uh-huh.
So it's just building. Mm-hmm. For that show in particular, it's taken me back a little bit. I'm like, oh yeah, this is fun. You know,
yeah.
And my selling point to get the comedians on board, a lot of them are coming from like an hour and a half, 2 hours away. Like, hey man, you're going to have a great time. And it's a Sunday afternoon. It's just
different. That's it, dude. That's what's key. Like it's like, you can tell who a comic if they're like, oh, a Sunday afternoon, I'll fucking do that.
Yeah.
What else I have, you know, like if I'm around, you know, like a Joe DeRosa or somebody like that in New York would jump on that in a fucking heartbeat.
Yeah.
And that, or a Canaan, you know, like those guys just, they're in it because they love it. And so, you know, money's important because it's the job and you don't want to discount yourself. You want to know your worth and all that jargon. But I mean, that shit is, I don't know if you, have you ever done Star Bar in Atlanta?
No.
Okay.
No, I really haven't traveled a whole lot.
Okay.
You know, I'm all the way through New York. I'm in Binghamton, New York. So it's like, we're three and a half hour. Yeah. 3.5 hours out of the city, but like enough. There's like a new scene every 60 minutes from me. So,
man, that's wild because I grew up in the Hudson Valley.
Oh, no shit. Yeah.
Yeah. And so I've been to Binghamton a few times. Although the last time I was there, I said it was the last time I do comedy there because it was
a lot of people are like that.
I did the Rod Serling Museum.
Yeah.
And the guy putting it on was very well intentioned and the show was fine. But it was one of these like, oh, I got to run down and do my bartending shift. I'll pay you out of the register. Like just a sketchy fucking setup. And I was like, man, that was an experience. So that's good to hear that there's people doing stuff up there again. Cause I was like, I don't know. This was 5 years ago, probably.
Yeah. So I started 5 years ago, like five and a half or whatever it is now. But yeah, so I think I know the guy you're talking about too.
Yeah.
So
nice guy.
In fact, I'm sure without naming names,
yeah.
When I started booking, I started booking shows. And again, I'm sure this is where you were, but I booked shows for me to get on stage.
Sure.
And it's like, okay, I'm going to host the show. And nobody can tell me I can't do my own show. I mean, they can hope, but it's not going to happen.
Right.
I started doing that. And then I started finding venues. And then there were a lot of times where I'd have to apologize for the last guy as I think you're talking about. And well,
it wasn't a big market back then. He was the only guy doing stuff.
No. And now I'm not the only guy, but I'm, I would say the most prolific in that area. So
that's good to hear. I mean, again, it wasn't a bad experience in terms of, you know, he treated us very well and did a good job, but it was just one of those, like, you know, that was weird.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
No. He's always good for a really fun story.
Yeah, it was a fun story. And I'm a huge Twilight Zone guy, so I like the Rod Serling aspect. That was neat.
Yeah, that's one of the only things Binghamton can point to. Like, yeah, and then Ithaca, because he went to Ithaca, Rod Serling.
Oh, really?
Like, yeah, they claim him too. And it's like, no, he went to Binghamton High School. So let us at least have that.
Yeah, fuckers.
You know?
But I did photos with Billy Idol in Binghamton once too.
Really?
I ran a magazine for many years and my wife and I drove up to Billy Idol to see him in a club, like a small club that was up there. I forget it's gone now. Shit. What was it called?
We had a club called the Empire Club a long time ago.
No, it was something else. It was in like a strip mall, but
oh,
it was a rock club.
Oh, I know what you're talking about. Man, how long ago do you think this was?
Dude, it had to be 16 years ago.
Because it was
one of the last shows we saw before we left New York and we moved here in 2005.
Man, it was something like Music City something.
Yes, that's what it was. That's exactly what it was.
Okay.
It was called like something Music City.
Yeah.
So, might have just been Binghamton Music City or something.
That used to be a Chuck E. Cheese when I was a kid.
Holy shit.
It was a Chuck E. Cheese.
Like that. Yes.
I saw Sum 41 and Unwritten Law there.
Okay.
I mean, wow. It would have been right when I graduated college, maybe 2004 or five. I think it was 2005. And then I moved out of the area, and then we had two floods, and it wiped it away.
Bummer. So, yeah, that's so funny. That was a Chuck E. Cheese because it totally looked like some sort of restaurant it used to be.
Yeah.
I remember they poured really strong, tall drinks, and I was drinking a lot. And Billy Idol was so fucking great. My wife took photos for an interview I was doing with him. I did a phone interview with him a few days later, and he was so cool. And people were like handing him Generation X records while he was on stage, and he would sign them and hand them back in the middle of the song. He's just the best, man. But that show stands out because we drove all the way up to Binghamton, just a road trip to see Billy Idol, and just got hammered and had the best time. And then, the next, I heard like, it was like 2 years later, the venue was gone.
Yeah, I think it closed in 06 or 07. Cause
that sounds right.
We had a flood, and I remember being in Lock Haven, Pennsylvania during that one. Cause again, we had one in 2011, and I was in Baltimore then. Yeah, we don't have a ton of really good venues anymore in Binghamton.
Yeah, I mean, even in Austin, it's increasingly less. I mean, we lost a lot during COVID, like everybody, but yeah, man, I don't know. It's good to hear though that you're doing stuff up there. That's cool. Upstate always needs movers and shakers.
Yeah. Do you think being a producer made you a better comedian?
That's a good question. I think it kind of goes, I guess, to the debate about whether or not you can teach comedy, right? Because there's always like comedy classes and all that sort of shit. And I don't think you can. I think you either have the thing or you don't. It is called the thing, you know, and you can tell in new comics, somebody that's brand new, they may not have much material. They may have 5 minutes, but you can be like, oh, you've got the thing. Like, you're going to be able to be a comic. And then you see some people that have, you know, spent 5 years hammering out their solid 15, and it's very funny and very pro, and they can get up and do that set for a while, but they don't have the thing. You know, they just don't have that spark. But I think what you can do by taking those comedy classes or whatever, and I've never taken one, but I think what you can do is learn mechanics, you know? So I would say, I don't think being a producer made me funnier. But I think the more time I spent producing, it helped me know the mechanics a lot better in terms of like how much a mic is important and using the mic to your ability and not speeding through your set, being aware of stage, you know, using silence and quietness to your advantage and just like all those sort of things, you know? So I would say that and just things that inform the show, like not having fucking 11 comics on one show, you know, like, you know, like having the seats up front and not distance from the stage and just all the intangible things that go into making a show good that you can control. You can't control the audience. You can't control if people are going to show up. You can't control bombing necessarily if just the things aren't going your way for whatever reason on a particular night, but you can control if the TVs are on in the fucking venue. You can control if the microphone works. You can control if there's a stool on stage to put your drink on, or if you're stuck holding it the whole time because you didn't think of it in advance, you know? So that stuff all really informs my stuff. And I'm a very much a details guy. And I think that's partially also another reason why Eddie and I get along is because when I go on the road, I'm so used to doing that stuff that everything's kind of handled, you know, like he doesn't have to worry about that stuff.
Every once in a while I get I don't know if it's an OCD thing or a control thing, but it's like, dude, I need to, comedy is at times so easy to produce. And it seems so hard when like somebody else does it.
Yeah. Cause like, they often do it wrong.
Yeah. I know for me, it's very difficult as a producer to go to a show that somebody else is putting on and I'm on the show
and not micromanage.
It is like, I need a buddy to vent to and, yeah, I don't want to be the asshole who's talking shit on the person at the show, but like I have to do that in order to kind of mute myself and not.
I totally get it. I don't think it's in my case, it's not OCD because I'm not OCD, but I am a control freak.
Yeah.
And it's not like my way or the highway. If someone's producing a show, I'm not going to be the guy who's suddenly fucking stepping on their dick. But if it's something that is going to affect the outcome of the show in a way, you know, because I mean, I'm dealing with different promoters every single night when Eddie and I are on tour, you know, and some of them are clubs. And I don't know how much you work with clubs, but clubs very much have things set the way they like them. You know what I mean?
They know it works.
Yeah. And it usually works, which is fine. There's usually not a problem. But if there's something specific, like what's a good example? The lights being too hot, You know, yeah. Sometimes the lights are so fucking bright, which from a crowd perspective is great because you can see everything. But if you're performing, A, it's hot, you know, and Eddie's 62. And so it's like you don't want to be baking up there for an hour. And B, if the performer can't see the crowd, then it's a problem for certain. You know, some people maybe not, but for us it is because we interact. We don't do crowd work really, but we interact with the crowd, you know. And you want, if there's an aside, you want to be able to launch off that and stuff. And so that's something that I'd be like, hey, we need to adjust these lights to make it fit. So I totally feel what you're saying there. I think it's everybody has to use their own internal barometer as to how much it matters. You know, what I mean? There's something like, oh, I would do this different. You know, something as silly as, oh, we have a bar stool with one of those backs on it. And to me, that looks shitty on stage. You know, it looks kind of sloppy and not great, but it's a stool on stage. If I was doing a show, I'd be like, I'm not going to say anything about that. Like fucking whatever. If it's my show, it's going to be a flat stool and it's going to be short and all those things. But you know what I mean? But if the fucking wireless mic keeps dropping, then I'm going to demand we get a wired mic in there before we do the show.
You know? I cannot do a show with a wireless mic. I don't know what it is. I have like a zero batting average with them. I can't do it.
They suck. They suck. They're never good. That you often get weird feedback and stuff. They're battery operated. So God knows that's unreliable. I always say, man, you know, for stand-up comedy, we literally need a microphone that works and a stage and a stool.
Yep.
And that's literally all you need. And so many times it's amazing to me how it, somehow it gets fucked up.
I travel around with a stool, a microphone, and a speaker. That's all. Yeah. That's all I need.
Yeah. And I'm a weirdo in that I like a straight stand if I can find one, as opposed to like a bendy stand, but not crucial.
Nope. I got the same thing.
But I mean, it's such a basic, you need like three fucking things. And so there's still somehow times where it's just like, yeah, it didn't happen. I did a show one time and they handed us like a lipstick mic. Like those tiny little fucking, I was like, are you kidding me? You know, and it's just like, okay, I guess this is all we have. And it's that Spinal Tap moment of just like, you know, okay, I guess we're rolling with this, but Jesus, you're making this simple job hard for no reason with mechanics.
I headlined a show one time. It was like a couple of years ago. And on the top of the mic was that just huge pop stopper.
Uh-huh.
And so the entire like hour plus, and they were like, again, there's like seven comedians on stage. And I'm like, oh boy. But I watched and I'm like, how do I get rid of that thing? And the comic before me took it off. I'm like, sweet. I can do it. And I was like, I just didn't know if it was glued there or what. And the first thing I did, I grabbed the microphone, took it off and went into my set. And I'm like, it meant nothing to anybody else, I'm sure.
Yeah, but the aesthetic of it was that you were going to be thinking about that instead of your set.
Yeah. I'm like, okay, well, do I bring it too far up? Am I going to hit my mouth? I mean, just weird things like that get in my head. And the thing I do as a producer, and a lot of people, I'm different in this around for the local shows where I do a max of four people on a show.
It's smart.
And I'm a host and I know I can go to three with some headliners. Mm-hmm. But if the headliner can't do more than 25, I'm like, well, okay, I got to do four. And that allows me to get people on stage, enough people on stage. They can stretch if they want. I don't need a light if I trust them. And it's just a more laid back, kind of like a punk rock feel to the shows. And a lot
I think that's the ideal sweet spot. I think you're smart to do that. I mean,
And it's a 90-minute show. I'm like, okay,
cool. That's it, dude. Less is more with comedy. It's so much better to, you know, like host, quick guest spot of like 7 minutes, feature, headliner, done.
Yep.
And, you know, the way Eddie and I do it is, you know, when we're working together, I do about 25 to 30. He does 45 to close to an hour, depending. But, you know, we have, if we can, I try and handpick the host for somebody that I've worked with in the past, you know, in each market. And then we generally leave room for one or maybe two quick 5-7 minute guest spots for the promoter to put in whoever they want. And that's it, man. That's fucking it. None of these long marathon. Nobody, the audience gets laughed out. It's not good for the show, you know. And there's times also where if they'll be like, oh, you know, we're having, for whatever reason, the host got sick or, you know, or we have these newbies, but they're pretty green. I'll just be like, fuck that.
Yeah.
Eddie and I'll just go, we'll go with that. I'll just go up top and I'll bring him up. You know, like there's no, That's a thing. That's a thing where you insert yourself is when it's going too long. Because I've also had shows where I show up. I did Boston one time at the House of Blues, and I showed up, and the promoter had booked 12 comics.
How does that happen?
I don't know, but it did. And I was so fucking mad. And they were good comics. They were all working class Boston comics. But it doesn't matter. And I, you know, ever since that happened, every time anything close to that has happened again, I say, well, that's fine. But we're doing our headlining. I'm doing my headlining set in the middle.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so I insist on going fourth or fifth in a lineup of over seven or whatever the fuck it is. And they're like, well, that's kind of unorthodox. So I said, well, that's your problem. You know what I mean? That's how we're doing this. Cause otherwise it's not going to work. And I didn't travel here to, you know, fucking go on in 2 hours. And that might sound arrogant, but it's I'm not going to do it. And I just refuse to do it. You know, I just say, well, I can not do the show, I guess. And we can go our separate ways, but there's people here I know who paid to see me. And so, you know, I'm going to do, if you want me to cut some time, I'll do maybe 30 instead of a normal headlining 45 or 50. That's okay. But there's no way I'm going on after nine people. I'm just not. And the only time I break that rule is during the comedy festival, during Altercation, because there's so many comics flying in for it that the audience is aware that each show is kind of longer than the average bear. So usually on Altercation, I'll have six comics total. And that's stretching it for me. But the audience is aware of it and they stick with it and they like it. And so it's not a situation where I feel like I'm breaking my own rules for selfish reasons. It's kind of ingrained. And that is the only time that I'll have a lineup that long.
Well, one of the last shows I had more than four people on it. And Zach Hammond, who's on the Altercation Festival.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I'm sure you know about him.
See him. Yeah.
And well, you shouldn't be, he sucks. But anyway, he's never going to listen to this anyway. No, I think if I tell Zach that I mentioned his name, he'll absolutely listen.
Yeah, that's a comic trait.
Absolutely. It's like the narcissism will go, oh, my name.
Oh, wow.
But no, I just did a show with him in Buffalo. And you know, what you said, I did the first 25. It was just me and him. And he did like 45, 50.
Nice.
And it was fantastic. It was such a great show.
Was it Nietzsche's or where'd you play in Buffalo?
No, it was a vineyard. Just torn. But anyway, I had Zach do a show for me at a brewery in April. And it was one of the first shows back. And he headlined, and you know, I didn't know exactly how long. With Zach, I'm like, all right, 30 plus, do what you got to do. And I'll have four people on it, you know, myself included, I'm the host. And we set up for him, but he wanted to bring a buddy of his to do a guest spot. And I'm like, okay. And the guest spot dropped out. And then somebody on the show was like, oh, can he do a guest spot? I'm like, yeah, absolutely. But I forgot. We were away from this place for a year. and it gets hot. And the guy who did the guest spot was really funny. Everybody on the show did great. But at a certain part in Zach's set, people got tired.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And it's not his fault. And they started walking out. And it wasn't because of his material. And it just, I was like, fuck, that's on me. Like, mm-hmm. I forgot completely the psychology of that room.
Yeah.
Because every room can be different too. And I was like, oh, that's why I went down from five to four.
Yeah,
because hey, there's a cat. All right, yeah, I got three cats running around, so they'll be around here.
My big boy, and the other thing that I tell comics a lot too, which I see, which is, you know, if somebody's booked to do a 15-minute spot, right, and they get a huge pop at 11 on a bit, so get the fuck off the stage.
Yeah, you know, showmanship, Jerry.
Dude, I see comics that are, you know, enslaved by their set list. I'm like, what are you doing? They're like, oh, I want to do my closer. I'm like, that was your closer.
Yeah.
Fucking, you got a fucking applause break. Get off.
You're
you
not going to match that.
So that's just another mechanics thing that just, you know, you in theory learn as you go. But I see a lot of comics that have been doing it for a long time that still just break that rule a lot. It just makes me scratch my head.
So when did the Altercation Festival come about? Like, what was the idea for this one?
Well, because I had that producer blood and I was booking my own tours for so long. A lot of comics that I work with had said, man, you should really do a festival. But I knew how much work that was going to be and startup money and all the things that you need to make it good. And the main thing was I was trying to find the right venue. And so I didn't find the right venue. I kind of was like thinking about it, but none of the venues I saw were ideal. And then I found this place, Kick Butt Cafe in Austin. I got asked to do a benefit show thing there for LGBT stuff. And I'd never been there before. I just thought, you hear coffee shop and I think, you know, acoustic guitars and burlesque or whatever. And I was like, this place is fucking perfect. Like the stage was huge. The PA was great. They had chairs. There was an elevated green room in the back that you could watch the stage, but it was closed off. I was just like, this is fucking perfect for comedy. And they were only doing like open mics once in a while or something. I guess they had a long running open mic comedy thing, but you know, I don't go to open mics that much, but no really produced comedy shows. And so I talked to the managers and really hit it off with them. They were cool, like heavy metal dudes, you know, stoner metal guys. And I was like, oh, this could work. And so it got me kind of thinking, I was like, well, this could be a really great place. It's got parking. It's outside of downtown, you know, the city. It's still in Austin, but it's not, it's away from all the paid parking and bullshit. It's like, man, this could really possibly work. And so that got my creative juices kind of going. And then I just started kind of ballpark talking. This was 6 years ago. I started talking to some label mates on Stand Up Records where I was signed at the time, like Chad Daniels and Christine Levine and, you know, just some comics that were friends of mine that were names. And they said, fuck, dude, I don't care about money. I'll just come in to do it. You want to fly me in? I'll do it. I was like, well, I can get enough money to fly you in and then just pay you what I can pay you. I think I paid Chad Daniels $200.
Hey, that's a steal right now.
And now I think he got the most downloads of any comic in 2021 or something. I don't know. Chad Daniels' new special just hit this week also. Go get it.
Oh, no kidding.
Okay. Yeah, 800-pound Gorilla Records, which is where I'm signed now too. But anyway, the first year was very much by the seat of my pants. And it was, I think I booked like 35 or 40 comics total. And it was strictly curated. I didn't take applications or any of that. It was, you're invited or you're not. And it went good. You know, people really liked it. The Altercation brand was familiar because that's what I had been touring under, the Altercation Comedy Tour. And so they're like, oh, it's that guy. And so there was a little bit of that. And it went well enough that I, you know, didn't lose any money, which for the first year is all you can ask.
A miracle.
Yeah, I didn't lose any money. I didn't make any money, but I didn't lose any money. And then the second year, people kind of heard about it as like the kind of the new cool kid thing in Austin, because there's, you know, Moon Tower Comedy Festival and a couple other comedy-based fests here. Out of Bounds, which is very well regarded, but it's more improv heavy and sketch, you know. And so then I wanted to up the game a little bit, and I just said, well, all right, well, let me just see if I can kind of raise the stakes a little bit. And I got some sponsors involved. Like Deep Eddie Vodka was sponsoring me at the time. And so I had a little bit of seed money from that. And so I called up Kyle Kinane, who's a buddy of mine. And I said, hey, would you come in and do it for this? This is all I've got. And he said, fuck yeah, I will. And so suddenly I had Kyle, you know, and like, and then it just snowballed, man. Cause it's like, I know a lot of comics from working, and it got to the point where, you know, Brian Posehn is going, hey, I hear your festival's great. When can I come do it? I said, fuck you now. You know what I mean? Stuff like that. And so it's last year, obviously I had a punt because of everything. Last year was going to be the fifth year. So this year is now the fifth year. But I mean, you look at the lineup and it kind of speaks for itself right now in terms of people that are on the show are there because they really want to come in and do it. And, you know, my budget is not insane. It's reasonable, I think, but it's certainly not as much money as they could be making if they did their own Austin stuff sometimes, which I really appreciate them doing. But I mean, also, you know, something Brian Posehn told me when he did it for the first time a few years ago, he said, man, you know, the thing booking agents forget is that we do this for fun also. And this is the most fucking fun I've had in forever, you know? And so it's really become kind of this comedian kind of fest without without the kind of arrogance of that, because there's certainly, when alt comedy was a thing, there was certainly kind of a look down the glasses vibe. And I'm certainly guilty of that as well. I'm an admitted comedy snob in a lot of regards. I'm a kind of a stand-up comic purist. So somebody pulls out a guitar, unless you're Henry Phillips, I'm going to roll my eyeballs at you. But that being said, I feel very fortunate that the fan base is so diehard that they'll come on a Wednesday starting at 7 p.m. and those motherfuckers will stay and laugh every night until 1 a.m. and then be back ready to go the next night. I mean, the last show, so 2019 was the last festival, and every single show was capacity with people at the door trying to get in.
That's insane. So
it's great, man. It's very organic. It feels good. And the thing I promised myself, you know, because I run a rock music record label and I have a business partner with that. And I've had offers for people to buy in as silent partners and stuff on the festival. And I sure could have used that money, but I said, no, I said, this is my own. I have no partners in the festival. I book it as I see fit. People are welcome to throw in their opinions and their, I would have done it this way is all they want, but everybody can fuck right off. It's my own thing. And I have no, I book it the way I want to book it and I run it the way I run it. And so far it's working. So
it's just you like just looking. So that's crazy. Now I you know, looked at the list of a bunch of the comedians you've had on there. You've got coming on there. And like, I just on this podcast, I've had Richard Douglas Jones, Zach Hammond, Shafi Hossein, and like, they're fantastic comedians. What do you look for in a comedian for this festival?
Well, I really, for the first few years, I think this is the first 3 years, I didn't take submissions at all.
Okay.
You know, because I understand a lot of comics. Well, I mean, off the top of my head, you can name probably five festivals nationwide that are all held in pretty high regard, right? Limestone, obviously Moon Tower with Austin, but that's big. But I'm talking kind of working class festivals. So like Limestone is happening right now this weekend in Indiana.
Yep.
What's some other good? High Plains out of Denver is really well regarded. Bridgetown used to be a hot shit one back in Portland when Matt Bronner was running that. So there's really just a handful. However, there are hundreds of comedy festivals, and a lot of them are just blatant cash grabs or people throwing a festival name on something that really is, it's really a local showcase, you know. It's just a marketing angle, which right on. But when people immediately start throwing, hey, come to our, you know, fucking Syracuse Comedy Festival, brand new. It's
nobody's going there.
Fly. It's just like, what is that? But comics will throw money at it because, like you said, they're listening for their name on the podcast to be said or whatever. It's that hustle aspect of comics where the one thing comics will get their shit together and throw money at is themselves, which right on. But it was very important to me to establish early on that that's not what I was doing. And I didn't want any part of that. You're always going to get naysayers saying, oh, if it's a festival, whatever, then that's what it is. It's a cash grab, but that's fine. They just don't have to come. but for the first few years, I'm like, I'm curating this so people know what it is. And then I realized I was going to keep it that way. I was just going to curate it all the time. But then I realized the bigger it got, the more seed money I kind of needed to get bigger people to make it, you know, Brian Posehn is my friend, but I also can't just be like, hey, come here for free or here's $200. You know what I mean? Like, I'm not going to do that. So I'm going to pay him as much as I can. And he in turn will accept it. And just because we're friends, but long tail on this kite. I know I'm really getting to
it. No, you're good.
I swear. But I realized a big thing was, in addition to having money that I could put back into the festival, because all the money from applications goes back into the festival. It's buying plane tickets. It's buying hotels. It's buying food every night to give to all the comics. It's buying booze, all the stuff. If I make any money, it's off ticket sales. And so I realized, though, because I was still on the fence about opening it up to applications, I said, motherfucker, at a certain point, I don't know everybody. There's comics. I want to be surprised by new comics. I want to find out new voices of people that I haven't just come across on the road that I think are good, like Richard Douglas Jones or, you know, or somebody that I just happened to work with when I was in Memphis or if I was in Hot Springs, Arkansas or whatever. I was like, oh, this person's great. Come do my festival, you know? And so what do I look for? I look for original voices. I look for diverse voices. I don't want an echo chamber. That being said, also, I don't lead with booking strictly because, oh, I need, you know, an Indian guy to open for Doug Stanhope.
Right. To justify that bit.
Right. You know what I mean?
Like, or three Indian guys.
Exactly. You know, like I don't book that way.
Right.
You know, three Indian nice.
Thank you. Thank you.
Sorry. It took me a minute.
my jokes usually do. That's why.
But, you know, we've had plenty of trans comics on the festival over the years, you know, and many of them are my friends, but this year we don't have any. And we had some apply, but they weren't funny enough.
Yeah.
You know, and I'm not like, I'm not sitting there going, oh man, I don't have a trans comic this year. I'm going to get really fucking roasted. I don't give a fuck. Roast me. Because my trans comic friends that have done it in the past who are very funny, I know will jump to my defense in an instant because I book with funny first, you know? And that's not to say the majority of applications I get are bearded white guys in my glasses. You know, that's just how it is. A lot of them are very funny, but not to the point where they're so overwhelmingly funny that that's all I'm going to book. You know what I mean? But what I look for is uniqueness, fearlessness, which is not edgelord shit. Fearlessness is just not shying away from specific topics or just having a point of view that may not be, maybe left of center, and just diversity of approach. You know, a lot of times that aligns with diversity of sexuality or race or whatever, which is great, but it's mainly diversity of approach. Somebody's doing something, you know, in a approaching comedy in a way that I find unique, then that's really intriguing to me. And I really like that. You know, there's a comic coming out this year from Denver, and I did a show with him in Chattanooga. He happened to be on the show, and he was doing just weird shit, man. Just, you know, I don't know if you know Sam Talent.
Yeah.
Okay. So he was a guy that Sam Talent recommended to me. And I just watched this dude. I'm going, man, he was like on stage pretending to be a centaur or some shit. And I'm just like, this is so out of the realm of anything I would ever do, but goddamn, this is making me laugh and it sure is weird. And I like it a lot. And so stuff like that, I'm going to get like 50 centaur videos now for the next stage. But basically like uniqueness and just tone, you know what I mean? There's just a specific intangible tone. At, you know, stand-up records always used to say they booked, you know, who they would sign on the old adage of like, you know, I can't define pornography, but I sure know it when I see it, you know?
Yeah. No, I think that's when I'm at a show, I don't want to see four of the same people.
Yeah.
And they could all look the same and, you know, I'd confuse them, but mm-hmm. I want to hear self-deprecation out of that guy. I want to hear one-liners from that guy. I want to hear a rant from that guy. Yeah. Separate yourself somehow. So if you're going to a six-person show at a festival, why group them all together? You know, why? Exactly. Because if you're bored by one of those guys, you're going to be bored by five more.
Exactly right. And I think, you know, the most rewarding part for me and the most work, I'm getting ready this next week. I'm announcing the nightly lineups for the festival, which runs October 27th through the 30th. And the curation of, all right, I have 80 comics. How do I want to flow this? You know, I really approach it like it sounds arrogant or pretentious, but like a museum curation. You know, I really take a lot of time to curate. All right, this person goes into this person who goes into this person who goes into this headliner or this feature. You know, that for me is a really rewarding and challenging aspect of running the festival. And I take a lot of fucking time to do it. So if somebody drops off, it's a big deal, you know, because suddenly I'm not just shoehorning somebody in that spot. I mean, that though is kind of the, this year I'm hosting, I run this live talk show called The Road Live, and I've got musicians and stuff coming in mainly to do that. And it's just gonna be like a live talk show thing. Cause I'm trying to do a stand-up set. Usually the crowd demands I do something. So I'll try and do like an unannounced stand-up set in the middle or something. But generally I try not to book myself time because I'm so busy running the shit. But the aspect of watching people enjoy the curation of it is what's the biggest charge for me. You know, like having people be like, man, that was a fucking great this into this. It's like being a DJ for a mixtape or something.
Yeah,
you know?
That's how I do a lineup. I feel like it's a playlist.
Exactly. Yeah, that's exactly right. That's why I agree.
Obviously, like the first person I book is a headliner. And I know I'm going to host, but mm-hmm. I've got a headliner. And then who works well with that person? Yeah. And like, I don't want, you know, the styles to be so jarring, mm-hmm. like so different, they're jarring, but like, I want them to flow with each other. And then I look at personalities. I'm like, well, are you going to work well with Zach?
Right.
Is that going to fucking hate you?
And right.
That, cause obviously if they don't like each other, chemistry's off.
Yeah, exactly. But another fun thing too, is like, you know, if I'm booking somebody to open for Tom Rhodes, you know, who's coming in this year, I've got my buddy English Matt, who's from Britain. And like, you know, Rhodes is a worldly comic. I think he recorded his last special, like 10 minutes in like 20 different cities or something like that, you know, or I'm across the world. Countries. And so that's something that they've never met, but I know that's going to be a nice cherry for like, Tom's going to like that. It's kind of a worldly showcase, you know? And the other thing too, is sometimes, you know, comics headliners, if they're my friends like Eddie or Kinane or, you know, Posehn or whoever, I want to put somebody on that showcase that they may not know. That's going to make them go, oh shit.
Yeah.
This person's really good and I need to step my game up. I don't want these fuckers to coast just on who they are and crowd enthusiasm. I want my headliners to work, you know, and I know, cause they're going to crush. They're going to crush either way, but there's a degree of people who are excited to see you because you're you from TV. And then, you know, you can do that and coast on that, or you can get up there and fucking destroy. I want everybody on stage to destroy, you know what I mean? And so sometimes by putting a little grenade of an unknown comic that I know is going to blow up that spot, you know, right before their feature and make them go, oh shit, I better look at my notes. I want Eddie to have to look at his notes. You know what I mean? Because I know that when he hits stage, then it's going to be electric.
I would imagine that anybody who's on a show with Eddie is going to want to do his or her best because, hey, Eddie might be watching me.
Well, that's another thing that I do, which a lot of festivals don't. It's all one singular venue because I've done comedy festivals, man. And there's nothing worse than doing your set and watching people get up and run to go see the competing thing at the same time that they want to see when they're enjoying what you're doing. You know, I did Hell Yes Fest in New Orleans and I was booked at the same time as Sean Patton. And we just watched our audiences get up and fucking run to the other venue and run in. And so it's all at one venue. Everybody gets one set, which people are going, motherfucker, I'm going to apply and then fly to Austin and then do one 15 minute set. That seems like a lot of effort for not much. I said, well, on paper, that's true, but you're going to do one 15 minute set before a completely ravenous, sold out, packed crowd where you've watched everyone destroy for the last two nights. And you're going to watch every single show, including every headliner, and have access to all that shit. Sometimes you go to festivals, you don't even get to see the headliners that you're performing with because you need to buy a ticket.
Yeah.
You know, get the fuck out of here. But it sounds like, oh, I'm doing one set, but I guarantee you the other reason I have people do one primary set is because they're going to be very concentrated on that set. And they're going to put every ounce of everything they have into making it the best set they can be. And so, you know, sometimes you do a festival, you do two or three sets, you're tired, you know, whatever, this one is not as well attended as the one that you think it's going to be later in the festival. So you'll do your shit, but you'll save some energy. Or maybe I'll workshop some stuff and not bring my A material because this crowd's light. If you're at my festival, it's going to be packed and you're going to bring your A game and you're going to fucking do everything you can to deliver on the nth degree. And I have seen comics that I know are good step up and before my eyes kind of break through to next level shit because it's the tightrope, you know?
Yeah. And that's gotta be such a fulfilling moment as a booker and a festival producer. It's like, oh yeah. Like obviously you can't take all the credit for what they,
I take none of the credit for that. I'm just setting up the parameters of them to rise to the occasion. And once or twice people have faltered because it can be a lot of pressure when you're looking out there and you're seeing, you know, fucking Kyle Kinane watching your set like this. it can be nerve wracking. And one or two people, we had one guy who, you know, he did okay, but he made weird choices. He did kind of like this depressing kind of story. And then he ran off stage and ran to the bathroom and threw up, you know, like it's just once in a while it goes the other way. But I'd say 90% of the time people just really rise to it and deliver. But that's all them. That's all them having that ready to go in the chamber and just being challenged to the point of wanting to deliver it.
Yeah. One of my favorite parts about being a producer is the fact that I can create future networking opportunities.
Oh, absolutely. That's part of the reason I decided to do this as well. That was a big reason for wanting to do the festival is that I travel around a lot. Most comics can't because it was scary for me too. I left my day job and just went, you know, but I mean, it's hard to fucking pay rent and also just get out there. You know, it's a hard thing to start until you're at a level where you're doing it. But I wanted these comics that run great little scenes to meet each other, just to become not necessarily friends, but at least peers and be able to network and build up scenes around the nation, you know, and maybe that's pie in the sky kind of idealistic and a little naive because comics are lone wolves a lot of the time, but I've seen it happen. You know, I've seen comics from Arkansas come down. People going, Arkansas? I said, yeah, the scene up there is fucking great. You know, Little Rock, I think, is the worst city I've ever been in, one of them. And I have no desire to ever go there again. However, Fayetteville is a college town about 2 hours north of it, and it's fucking great. I'll go there and do five shows in 3 days, you know? And people go, where's Fayetteville, Arkansas? I'm like, well, they're coming here so you can meet them. And, you know, Stetson Banks is a comic from up there, and he's one of the ones that broke out, you know, 3 years ago. He just destroyed on stage. You know, people going, Jesus Christ. You know, there's a guy down in Daytona Beach, Florida, you know, who came up and just fucking wrecked shop in 2019. You know, so it's that I'm glad that, yeah, we have a lot of aligned thoughts here, man, because the networking thing is crucial. And a lot of times, you know, if you, I don't know how it's like it sounds like you're running a lot of stuff, but if you're, when you drop in on a showcase or something, when I drop in on a showcase around town and I do a set, there's nothing more disheartening than watching the comic that was just on stage immediately go outside and drink beers with his friends instead of watching the show.
Yeah.
So fuck you too. But there's a reason those comics will stay local.
Yeah, I noticed that a lot of scenes, and I don't really think it happens with my shows. And I think part of that is, like, I book a lot of people, but I don't book assholes. And
well, that's key. Oh, dude, that's key as well. That's I've had agents reach out to me, which is heartening too. Now at the point, like, agents that an agent reached out to me that handles Seinfeld and Chris Rock. Okay,
it's probably done all right.
This is in 2019. And they said, we'd like to book this person, this comic, which I didn't know the comic, but they were kind of a new signing to them. You know, they're like this new person they were kind of trying to break in. And I was like, no, because I don't know them. And I'm not going to bump one of these other features that I've already booked to put your, and they were aghast. They were like, couldn't believe I was telling them no. And there's been other comics that I think are fucking assholes, regardless of funny. You know, some of them can be funny. But just people that I know are fucking dicks because I've worked with them and I've seen how they act and I see their arrogance or whatever. And their agents have been like, hey, so-and-so is interested in doing it. I'm like, yeah, hard pass. No thanks. And they're just like, what?
Yeah, and everybody wants this guy.
They're a draw. You know, they do put asses in seats, but I'm not going to work with an asshole, man. And there's been times where comics have shown up that I don't know because I don't know everybody that applies. So there's 60% of this lineup coming in probably I've never met before, you know? So there's always a chance that they could be off-putting, but I don't know if you show up and I had a comic one time asks if they could go earlier in the lineup on the show because their friend was in town and they wanted to go out drinking.
Fuck you.
And I was just like, yep, sure. No problem. Moved them earlier. And I was like, and now I will never book you again. Yep. I'm just like, okay, I'm not going to be mad about that, but just bye.
I was on a show one time. I got booked to it's called Maddie B's. It's like the only comedy place we had for a while. Uh-huh. And producer booked me and she hosted the show. And then I went up, I might've gone up first or second. Oh no, I'm sorry. I hosted the show and she went up third. And the first guy on, he was kind of a late add to the show. Uh-huh. And he brought a couple of friends and they sat in the front and then he did his set. And well, during my set, his friends' phones went off. And one of them answered the phone and had a conversation, uh-huh, like maybe 6 feet from the stage.
Yep.
And I'm like, hey, can you, and I was really new, relatively sure, new at least. And I didn't know how to handle it, but went well. And then he did his time. And then as I'm introducing the producer, that guy and his friends get up and they leave to go hang out downtown.
Yep.
I never booked him after that. I was like, nope. Yep. And she was like, why wouldn't you book him? I go, why would you do it again?
Yeah.
Like that. Yeah. Is such an asshole move, mm-hmm, that I wouldn't affiliate myself with him.
Yeah, you're right too, man. And it's an easy thing to just note. And then I have very, very little scene beef with anybody, you know, yeah, because I don't really engage in it, but I have a memory like a fucking elephant. And so, you know, I just note those things and go, okay, noted. You know, I just have this Rolodex in my head. You know, this will go down on your permanent record. You know what, yeah, I mean? And it's just, I just book accordingly. You know, you don't have to give people a reason why you don't book them. Just don't book them.
Yeah. Work
harder. Easy thing to do.
What's the worst show you think you've ever had?
Man, my last special, Misanthrope, on Stand Up Records, I told a story about, it wasn't so much a bad show as it was an insane show, where I was in rural Oregon in like 2010. And we did this Halloween show at like this costume shop. And a Misfits cover band was playing and they were like a born again Christian libertarian Misfits cover band. And my opening host guy was judging this costume contest. Like our sets went good. And then it was filled with all these kids and he gave away the costume contest he said the scariest street walking crack whore I've ever seen. You're horrifying. He gave it to this girl who started crying, and that was the lead singer's girlfriend. Or
oh, no.
And so the band proceeded to rile up the crowd to kick our ass, where we had to flee the venue. We had to, like, literally get paid, silently put our shit in the car, and then they ran after us, like, throwing rocks and shit. So that was one that just went completely haywire. But the worst show I did in memory was, I was on tour with my buddy Mishka Shubali, who's a brilliant musician and writer, who I met via Stanhope. And this was a few years ago. We were in Hollywood doing a show. And I hadn't booked, Mishka had booked the show, so I didn't have any of the details or whatever. But I'm like, oh, cool, Sunset Strip. Like, this will be cool. And we got there. The drummer from Poison was sitting inside and stuff like this kind of hair metal place, right? Well, I'm like, there's no stage. They're like, oh, it's in the back. I'm like, okay. So you go down this hallway. And it was like, I like a good speakeasy, right?
Yeah.
However, not when it's a show you're trying to advertise. So it was literally, the venue was like, you had to pull a bookshelf to get behind the wall to find the stage venue. And it was like impossible to find. So turnout was garbage. There was like, I don't know, 20 people there who managed to find the place. I was going up early. I was in a bad mood. Do you know Brendan Walsh?
Yeah, I know the name at least. Todd Barry loves him.
He's good friends with Stanhope, and him and Mishka go back. So Brendan Walsh was on there, who I admire Brendan's comedy very much. He lived in Austin for a long time when I was first starting, and so he was kind of a big deal. And so Brendan was there kind of watching, and I was going up early. Mishka was headlining it, and it just wasn't going well. Like, everything just felt off. And then the fucking bartender, I said, you know, tip your bartender. And then she started heckling me. And I got real pissed off, and I just like was like, well, then fuck you too. You know, like, I just want people to tip you. I'm like, don't tip her. I hope you die alone here. You know, fucking how dare you? You know, it's the unspoken, you know, enemy of my enemy is my friend shit. Like, we're in this foxhole together. You're heckling me. You work here. Fuck you. So that became antagonistic, and it was just awful. And I just got off stage. And Mishka went up and did his thing. And I just hid behind the stage and drank warm beer. Like, they gave us like this 12 pack of PBR. And I was just like, I don't want to do comedy anymore. This is fucking awful. Oh, that was the other thing. I do this festival, Punk Rock Bowling in Las Vegas, which is a big punk rock festival.
Oh yeah. Heard about
it. And for years I curated the comedy with Joe Sib, who runs Side One Dummy Records. It's home to like Flogging Molly and Gogo Bordello and all that.
Used to be Suicide Machines.
Yes, that too.
Yep.
And so Joe and I had many successful shows running the punk rock bowling thing. And that's, punk rock bowling is run by the Stern brothers, who are in Youth Brigade, Mark and Sean. And Mark and Sean had never seen us do comedy. They just always showed up after the show was done, when there was fucking 800 people that just left. Like, oh, I heard it was good. We're like, there was 800 people here just a minute ago. We just killed this thing and you didn't see it. God damn it. Well, Mark lives in LA, and that was the show he decided to finally make of mine. The one where I ate shit when there was 20 people there yelling at the bartender. And so I was like, God damn it. And like, you know, I got off stage and he was already gone, because it was just such a mess. And I was just so deflated. And then Mishka does his thing, and then he comes down, and the promoter was like this person made of cocaine, just mirror shades, snowman. And he had bounced with all the money.
Oh, of course.
And so Mishka is just on the phone going, I'm going to hunt you down, motherfucker. You know, Brendan Walsh is in the corner just looking at me. And I just felt like complete and utter failure. So like, that was a great Hollywood story. It was a great Sunset Strip. Like, I wanted to be the girl who gets back on the bus from the Guns N' Roses video and just goes back to Ohio. That's how I felt. I wanted to pick up my backpack and go home to the heartland, because Jesus Christ, like, Hollywood just chewed me up and spit me out in the span of an hour. So that was a bad one. But most of them have been good. I'm in this for the stories. And, you know, even when it's bad, sometimes it's fun and I get a zany tale out of it. So I haven't had too many real nightmares, fortunately.
It's been a while for me, too. And but those, I think I'm running with a joke now where it's when we're transitioning to the outdoor stuff. Like, mm-hmm. I had one woman, I was just running an open mic, and she just came in there from, like, I think she was hanging out watching live music and then came over.
Oh, yeah.
Sat down, older lady. And a buddy of mine, a comic, he said that I had a joke where I was talking about how when my nephew was like four, he's a real wise ass. And even when he got out of the tub and he came over to me, and he's wearing his towel, and he says, Uncle Mikey. And I ignored him. And then I finally looked, and he had dropped his towel and said, are you jealous? Which is fucking great timing.
That's hysterical.
Yeah. And so I was telling the story, and as soon as I mentioned that part, my buddy's like, yeah, she sat down and she goes, that's it.
She got it. That was it.
Yeah. So she ended up calling the town on me.
She called because the town on you?
She got the government involved. And it was like, somebody called me the next day, because I don't even know how they exactly got my information. But they're like, yeah, are you the guy who's running the open mic at Glendale Park? And I'm like, yeah. And I was like, yeah, we had a complaint about the language.
And so what?
I was like, and I didn't want to tell him, yeah, that was me. And also, here's the joke. It wasn't bad. And I didn't use dick. I used penis. It was like, all right, you just whatever. But I really like when something like that happens because it's like, yeah, it sucks kind of at the moment.
Yeah.
But now it's a year later and I'm still getting enjoyment out of what happened.
Man, that's so funny. I put on a music show one time and it was an outdoor thing. It was like this punk rock brunch. You know, it was like Sunday at like, it was like 2 p.m. And I booked this band called the Glory Holes from Memphis, which is an all gay punk band. And they're singing about whatever. And the cops show up and I'm like, it's 2 p.m. And they're like, yeah, the library called because they heard someone was yelling about butt fucking or something. And I was, and there's three dudes in leather on stage. And I was like, hey guys, the library police are here. We need to, I guess you can't do this on the Lord's Day. It was so fucking random.
That's so great though.
Yeah. That's wild that she called the town on you though. That's a weird thing.
Yeah, it was like, oh, the town and union's on my phone. Like, all right, that's interesting. I don't know. That's part of the cool part about comedy is like for me, it's like, yeah, I keep everything in my car and you never fucking know what's going to happen.
Eddie and I, we just did the Laughing Tap in Milwaukee, which is a great club. But the last show we did was kind of a bad, he walked some Trump supporters in the middle of his set. And at the end, we're hanging by the merch table and this woman comes up, this very much, like, you know, middle-aged, well-to-do kind of wine mom. And she was like, oh, man, that was just terrible. That was awful. And we're like, okay, cool. You know, she's fucking around. And then we're like, wait, you're not fucking around. She's like, I spent so much money here. I spent like $200. That was awful. That was the worst thing I've ever seen. That was horrific. You should be ashamed of it. She just went off on us. And we're going, this is fucking hysterical.
Yeah.
Eddie and I are looking at each other going, I mean, Eddie crushed. Like, the show was good, you know. But there was just some pockets of, this is not what I signed up for. I'm just looking at this lady going, I don't know if she's fucking around or not, you know, because it feels like she's kind of kidding. But by the third time, we're like, no, she's really mad. She really did not like that at all.
What do you say? Do you want to buy a hat?
Yeah, I was like, yeah, free sticker. I don't know. There's no comment cards here, dummy. So I don't know, man. But yeah, I mean, the stories is where it's at, right? That's the big reason I do this shit.
What merch do you have?
Oh, dude. I've always been – Mishka and I bonded over the merch thing because I don't know how – you go on tour and don't have merch, you know, it's such, that's the punk rock thing in me too. It's that you fucking, that's how you made money in a band. Yeah. And so, I mean, fortunately Stand Up Records pressed two of my things on vinyl and I've got a, you know, an album DVD combo thing and I do my own shirts. And so I've got, you know, Eddie and I right now have like 2 or 3 different shirt designs that sell real well. What else? Oh, I have like pins of, like they did art for my last special, which was like a skull with my glasses. And so they're like die cut pins and, you know, a little bit of everything, but mainly vinyl and t-shirts are the main things that I deal with. So, which is a lot to fucking lug around, but they tend to sell well. And oh, the other thing Eddie and I have been doing is we've been doing a limited run of just 10 or sometimes 20 posters for each show. So we do like kind of sign and numbered 11 by 17 posters that I do the layout for. So that's something we've been doing lately. That's been cool. You know, you need to print up 15 posters and charge $10 a piece and they go super fast. That's an extra $150. That's like gas and dinner and
dinner,
you know, so.
Yeah. I run all my shows under Homebrewed Comedy and I've got a really nice logo and like, cause I didn't want to put my fucking face on a shirt or something like that.
Yeah.
Like
branding is so important. Yeah.
Yeah. And so, but I've got that and I'm like, okay, well maybe I can sell shirts or whatever, but my mindset, I have so little confidence. I'm like, oh, cool. I'll get 100 shirts made. And then I'll have 100 shirts forever.
Yeah. Like, I always tell people to order low, do whatever the minimum is, get 24. Usually you can get 24 shirts made and just test the waters. You know, that's a good point though, too. Cause I also wanted that with the comedy festival. I didn't want my face on it. And so it's just Altercation Comedy Festival. I had a buddy of mine, Jim Ether, who's a great cartoon drawer, draw me up this devil. I'm like, give me a devil with a microphone. And he drew it up and like, you know, just use that as the logo, you know, so I don't have to be a placeholder because I don't want my face on that. Like when Eddie and I are touring together and it's just us, I'm okay with like artist rendition, but I hear you on that. It can be kind of squirrely.
Yeah. I mean, I've got, you know, and I'm weird. Like I've got On the Mic with Mike Peters, like it's right over my shoulder. So like, yeah, absolutely. I'm in love with myself a little bit. Like I think to do comedy, you kind of have to be, but well, yeah.
Yeah, but here's the thing, too. So for years and years and years, I just booked it as the Altercation Punk Comedy Tour, right?
Yeah.
it took a bunch of people, including Stanhope, saying, you need to put your fucking name on this. Cause it was only me and whoever I was bringing by the end of it. And that was a hard thing to learn. But also, if I hadn't done that, I wouldn't have gotten signed probably, you know, to where I'm at. It's just like, you need to kind of prioritize yourself at a certain point and get over that hump because nobody else is going to do it for you. And that's a punk rock thing too. There's a gross aspect of like, ew, I'm going to put my name on something. That's not punk rock. Well, punk rock and comedy diverge there. You need to fucking promote yourself, you know?
Yeah, so. You know, it's that whole selling out thing. It's like, well, yeah, but you also need money too. Yeah. Like you can't get around that. Like, yeah, you can say, oh, Green Day sold out, or but it's like, well, they wanted a house.
You know what's punk rock to me? Not having a boss and setting your own. That's what's punk rock to me now at 45. So fucking, you know, everybody else can. I haven't had too many arrows and slings thrown my way in that regard because I try to not make money my priority, you know. Right. But I'm also not gonna, you know, I need to fucking, I'm an adult with a mortgage, you know. So.
Well, man, I appreciate this. This is amazing. Anything else you want to plug?
No, the only other thing I guess to say is I started making these custom action figures under JT Custom Toys. So if you're on Instagram, go to JT Custom Toys and follow me on there. It just started because I couldn't tour during pandemic. So I've been fucking around making these one-off art pieces. And now like they've gone to David Lynch and Patton Oswalt and all these people. So yeah, just check that out. There's a Facebook group too. And just altercationcomedyfest.com is the spot for all the festival shit. If anybody happens to be around Texas or is feeling excited enough to want to get on a plane, it's the end of October for 4 epic nights.
Hey, some people really like Greg Abbott and they just want to go and talk to him.
Yeah. Yeah. Come here and wheel him around a little bit. Get him some sun.
You know, Jim Abbott was so inspirational. You know, it's like to have the Abbott name devalued all this time. Yeah.
Eddie does a great bit about how he thinks Greg Abbott should have a cat named Costello and just sit on his lap and become a full supervillain, just doing Abbott and Costello routines while he plans how to overtake the world.
That'd be fantastic.
Fucking good when Eddie does it.
You don't see a whole lot of governors with cats.
Yeah.
You know?
Nah, because they're fucking solipsistic, amoral assholes that pets run away from.
All right. Well, now I'm going to have to go look up a word. So thanks for that.
Oh, sorry. Self-centered.
Just say stupid. Something like that. Like that's my wheelhouse.
Self-involved.
Thank you. That saves me a whole lot of time. Now I have nothing to do today.
There you go.
So whatever. But no, really, thank you so much, man. It was amazing talking to you.
Yeah, man. Thanks so much. Actually, Eddie and I are going to be on the East Coast too in October. I keep forgetting you're in New York. So
yeah, let me know.
If you go to eddiepepitone.com or jtcomedy.com, you can see the dates. I know Eddie's got all the ticket links on his, but we'll be doing, we're doing some Pennsylvania stuff and we're doing City Winery in New York City. And
Poughkeepsie.
We're doing Poughkeepsie.
Yes, Paul Kosowski told me about that.
Yeah, we're doing the Laugh It Up Comedy Club. We're doing two nights and three shows there. We're doing Woodstock, New York. We're doing Albany, New York, where we've never done before.
Albany's a good scene. You'll like it.
Yeah, I'm excited for it, man. I used to do rock shows up there at Valentine's back in the day, but I haven't been up there to do comedy.
I saw one of the only concert I ever saw in Albany. I saw Midtown in the reunion show.
Oh, I remember Midtown. Jeez.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. A long time ago. It was 2002, 2003, maybe.
Yeah. I'm old enough. I used to go to the QE2 up in Troy and shit when I was.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
But we're doing the Rogue Island Comedy Festival in Rhode Island and Massachusetts and stuff. So yeah, just go to eddiepepitone.com, but we'll be there pretty much from the end of September through the middle of October. So
sweet, dude. Well, again, thanks so much, man. I'll talk to you
in a bit. Thanks so much for having me. I'm peeling back my sunburnt skin. I'll wait outside your bedroom. I hope they let me in.